So I'm going to have to start this devotion by begging for your attention. I would hope that since you're watching it, you are paying attention. But in this devotion in particular, I want you to, as I had a grade school teacher say, put your thinking caps on. Because we're going to have to try to get into the mind of Moses. And what we'll find is he's got a concern for this fundamental truth about human nature. My nature, your nature, the nature of everyone watching this. Now, we said in a previous devotion that it's important to remember the Genesis story in the context of who is writing and who's being written to. In Genesis, Moses is recording history from creation itself all the way through the Hebrews' captivity in Egypt. And he's writing in order to remind those Hebrews who have escaped from Egyptian captivity, and they're on their way to the promised land. He's reminding them, here's who God is, and here's where you've come from, and here's what your big problem is. And because of that, the book of Genesis can be pretty easily divided into two main sections. In the second section, by far the majority of the book, chapters 12 all the way through chapter 50, deal with the patriarchs of the Hebrew nation, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's sons, which become the tribes of Israel. But the first section is vitally important to the story. Before focusing on that specific family and nation, God plans to work through them, but Moses, before focusing on them, Moses tells us the broader story of all humanity. And so there's the creation story in chapters 1 and 2, and then in Genesis 3, we have the fall of humanity through the rebellion of Adam and Eve. God said mercifully at that time that he would put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of Satan. Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. One of the things we see in that verse is an understanding that there will be seed, there will be generations, offspring of people who can be identified with Satan, and there'll be seed who can be identified with the woman, Eve, who God's dealing graciously with. And despite her sin and rebellion, God is dealing mercifully with her. Even while exiling her and Adam from the garden, God clothes them and covers them and gives them hope, gives them that promise. But that seed of the serpent is seen right away. Cain, as you know, he still wants to define good and evil for himself. He thinks God should conform to his human thinking. And ultimately, when God accepts Abel's obedience and rejects Cain's rebellion, Cain is moved to jealousy and he murders his brother. In the New Testament, the Apostle John says it this way. He says in 1 John 3:12, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, right? He was of the seed of Satan. He was of that wicked one and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? You know, why did he slay him? Because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. So right away we see a godliness and righteousness, but we also see an enmity that God had promised. But it doesn't stop with them. After the first murderer, we see even more sin. In Genesis 4, Moses records the advance of civilization. If you read Genesis 4, you'll find the development of cattle farming and building cities and writing and playing music and working with metal by making brass and iron tools. But you'll also find the advancement of sin. You find this descendant of Cain named Lamech taking multiple wives and bragging that he's murdered, it appears, 10 times as many as his great-great-grandfather Cain had murdered. So civilization advances, and sin multiplies with it. Now, in the middle of that story of the fall, God made that promise in Genesis 3:15 that the seed of the woman, some future descendant of Eve, would crush the head of the serpent, Satan. So even as Moses is recording humanity's downward spiral into sin, he's also tracing that promise for us. He gives us the first of the infamous genealogies that have become so common in Scripture. And actually, he gives two sets of genealogies for these two seeds of Satan and Eve. You see in Genesis 4, he starts by recording the descendants of Cain to Enoch and Irad and Mahujael and Methusael and Lamech. And then after that, he gives an even more detailed accounting of the descendants of Seth to Enos and Canaan and Mahalalel and Jared and Enoch and Methuselah and Lamech. By the time you've made it five generations, in one lineage you have a man who writes songs about being a murderer, and in the other you have a man named Enoch who walked with God. So you can see, I hope, how Moses is doing these two things at once, right? He's recording humanity's downward spiral into sin, and he's also tracing that line of promise from Genesis 3:15. And it's in that context that Moses records for us the story of the flood. Again, I use that word story, but it's not fiction. It is a true story. We would think that since God's destroyed the earth with a flood, washed it clean of humanity's sin, that of course Moses is going to record that for us. It's a vital account of human history. But you also need to see how the entire flood story fits into those two themes that Moses is developing. First off, if God is going to fulfill his promise, he won't be able to destroy everyone. There has to be that descendant of Eve who's going to come in the future and crush Satan's head. And so, who do we find enter the Genesis story? Well, from the godly lineage of Seth, we see the next generation down is a man named Noah. And here's what Moses has to say about Noah in Genesis 6, verses 8 and 9. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. By saying perfect in his generations, Moses is not saying that Noah was without sin. In fact, going forward, we're going to see that's not the case at all. But Noah's genealogy was unmarred. He's a pure descendant of Seth, and he's not connected to that lineage of Cain whatsoever. And so he's a suitable person through whom that Genesis 3:15 promise could be traced. And yet, Moses also tells us that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. It's grace. It is the undeserved favor of God that brings Noah into this story of redemption, not anything particularly worthy about Noah himself. Without the grace of God in his life, Noah would have remained part of that downward spiral of sin into which all humanity has fallen. And so that's one theme of Moses, that lineage of the promise of God. And the other theme of humanity's descent into sin and wickedness serves as an explanation for God's judgment in the flood. Look at Moses' description of humanity as he leads up to the flood account. In Genesis 6, verse 5, God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Now, despite the fact that it's coming so early in Scripture, Genesis 6:5 is one of the most detailed descriptions of the problem of sin. And it is massively important if we're to understand ourselves. We've seen how we were created. We've seen how humanity rebelled. We've seen how that sin is trending worse and worse. And now we see this frank assessment by God himself of what these human creatures have become. Maybe it'd be helpful to break down some of the details of that verse and deal with the reality of sin. So let's note some facts about sin just from that verse in Genesis 6. Sin is natural. That is, it's part of our nature. Later in Genesis 8:21, this description of the imagination of man's heart is going to be repeated. And it says, the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. We are born with sin. It is in our nature. We also see sin is immense. The magnitude of sin is seen here. The wickedness of man is great, it says. Sin is no small issue. It's immense. Sin is pervasive. Every imagination of the thoughts of our heart are plagued with sin. Every imagination. We were made in the image of the Creator, but our creativity is bent imagination, which is encompassed by evil. Sin is pervasive in that sense. Every imagination of our heart. Sin is inward. You know, Jesus is going to come along later and teach sins not just about outward action, but it's the inward character of the heart. But really, that's an echo of Moses here. He says sin comes from the thoughts of our heart. And sin is absolute. Those evil imaginations in our heart are, Moses says, only evil. Only evil. It's hard to imagine Moses saying, well, there's a little bit of good in everybody, isn't it? There's only evil. And then we can also see sin as persistent. If we dwell on that word continually, we'll know that this natural wickedness of our heart isn't just displayed occasionally. It is continually. Sin is persistent. The principle Moses is putting forward here in stark terms explains the motives of God in destroying the world with a flood. And despite all the skeptics that are out there, the flood is a literal event. God would not tolerate the rebellious wickedness of mankind. Sin is a universal catastrophe, and so we shouldn't be surprised to find the catastrophic consequences. In fact, in 2 Peter 3, the Apostle Peter uses the flood judgment as a prototype of the final judgment that's still to come. But we can't forget Moses' other principle here either. While God is determined to punish the wickedness in his wrath, we also see he's determined to save some of humanity from his wrath. He's not a God who forgets his promises. And so in grace alone, God intervenes in the life of Noah and draws him into this story of redemption. So that's what leads up to the flood. In the next devotion, we'll look at the aftermath of the flood. And what we're going to see there is how little has really changed.